The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the world's first global fintech podcast. This is JP Nichols. This week, we have a special episode from the Plug and Play Demo Day in Silicon Valley. Plug and Play invited us to come out and record the day at their facility. We interviewed Scott Robinson, who runs the fintech program there, and we interviewed three of the startups that were demoing so we could give you a sense of the diverse set of issues that they're tackling. First, we have a couple of quick conference announcements. Finovate returns to New York City September 11th through 14th with an expanded Finovate Fall. Register now at fall2017.finovate.com and make sure to enter our special partner promotional code BREAKINGBANKS20 to save 20% on the current ticket price. Registration has also begun for BAI Beacon in Atlanta on October 4th and 5th. They have a really interesting track. They work with our friend Matteo Rizzi, who never disappoints. We'll be there, and our listeners can get a discount with the code B32. And of course, Next Money returns to Chicago, more at nextmoney.org. All the details are on our sponsors and conference partners page at breakingbanks.com. Now that we have that out of the way, a few weeks ago, our show's producer Rachel and I went to the Plug and Play FinTech Demo Day.
We took the facility here, right in the heart of Silicon Valley, here in Sunnyvale, California, in 2006. This facility is the old Philips wafer manufacturing plant. It's nestled right between Google and Apple and many other folks. LinkedIn's just down the street. So it's a very unique offering for startups to have office space.
That was Scott Robinson, the founder and VP of the FinTech program, or Vertical, as they call them here. You can imagine with that kind of location, Plug and Play is now the largest startup accelerator in the world. It was the brainchild of Saeed Amidi, who was working in commercial real estate, and then, well, I'll let Scott explain.
Absolutely. Plug and Play started in proper as an investment arm back in the late 90s. Our CEO, Saeed Amidi, watched a lot of the activity that was occurring in Sandhill with the dot-com era, and of course, wanted to get into the game. And so he found an opportunity with some of his extra office space. So he began to lend that out to folks that were sometimes uncreditworthy entrepreneurs. And so one of the first tenants was Pierluigi Zappacosta from Logitech. The next two tenants would be Larry and Sergey from Google. So Google grew from 3 to 50 people in this facility. The next two tenants would be Max Levchin and Peter Thiel. So they were able to turn the 2 years of rent, one of them, back into a position in the company. And so with that, the idea was born, having a co-working space or at least a facility where startups could build product as a line of sight for investment opportunity. And so that was our initial play, offering co-working for perhaps cheaper than market and cherry picking the great investment opportunities.
In case anyone was wondering, yes, Peter Thiel and Max Levchin began PayPal there. The first three companies that were born at Plug and Play were Logitech, Google, and PayPal. Not a bad start, as it became known as University 165. After they cherry-picked some of the best investments, larger corporations started coming to them asking about solutions for other business issues. One of the early ones was Volkswagen. Knowing that Volkswagen would not be the only company looking for solutions to the same issue, they decided to hold a camp. They brought in startups to address the problems that Volkswagen wanted to solve across the value chain.
I'm looking at solutions across, you know, the entire value chain for a car manufacturer, so software, hardware, etc. And of the 10 companies, 7 landed a pilot with Volkswagen, but the 3 that did not were effectively killed. So in other words, when Toyota or Ford or somebody else came asking, why aren't you working with Volkswagen? You just went through the program. There wasn't a sufficient answer.
But the startups didn't necessarily fit into the larger corporate culture. They faced a lot of issues, inside politics, or as I like to call it, the business prevention departments that pilot programs inside large companies usually face.
And so through the years, we began to kind of look at a business model that was slightly different and as to how we could bring leverage back to the startup. Of course, we've been making investments all through this time. So back in 2006, 2007, we had a program called Startup Camp. So you can think of that as very similar to an early stage incubator. It still runs today. We hold that twice a year. It's basically idea stage startups. We take a portion of their equity. We give them a little bit of money. We try to basically find the next big idea that we can push out. Through the while, right around 2012, 2013, a conversation occurred between our good friend Michael Calbert from KKR at the time and our CEO. And the question was, you have all this activity in retail, a lot of portfolio companies, why not capture the entire domain and enable these startups to get a faster path to market while creating almost a scarcity or a competitive environment? And so we launched this first model with our brand and retail programs. That's fall 2013. And the idea was, we already know that a lot of these partners are working together as it exists in their relationships. How do we optimize the path for the startup across an already existing relationship? And not only that, but the feedback, the signal from the industry brought a lot of value to the startup, not only just for reconciling what the product might mean, but also understanding the path and why you would actually work with a large corporate. So in many of these different industries, which we've now launched since then, so I lead FinTech, which was the second or third vertical that we launched. And I'll back up afterwards, explain why I'm such a big Bitcoin fan. But sure. That's really how, that was my foray into FinTech. We launched with this concept of, let's put our startups in a position where if we have Pepsi and Coca-Cola in the same room, let's let the startup be able to decide what the deal might be and play them off each other in a sense that, this is not going to enable the political problem that we saw, or, it creates this kind of expedited path for the startup to build product. So flash forward to today, we have over 11 verticals, 180 corporate partners. Just in FinTech alone, we've got 32 financial institutions, number of different kind of data partners as well.
What makes a company decide to come to you for help? And particularly, you started with the story of Volkswagen. And they're full of engineers. They've got an R&D department. Why do they need an outside partner like Plug and Play?
When you look across a lot of the acquisitions and the activities that occur, particularly for companies that we think of as innovative, so Apple or Google or otherwise, it's very clear that there's a number of different ways innovation can enter the corporate. It can be in-house, it could be augmented through a lab or a third party, or it could be an acquihire acquisition. So I think the reasons why startups come to us is twofold, particularly for our vertical programs. Number one, we don't require equity. So that's a very unique offering. That enables us to work with later stage companies. So for example, if you're asking for 7% of a company for $120K, a company that's raised $30 million is going to scoff at you and laugh you out the room. However, the second big value proposition for us is through all these partners that we have basically penetrated horizontally across the institution. So for example, with Deutsche Bank, we work with John Cryan and Kim Hammonds. They've been here on site and met the startups that were furthest along with the relationship with Deutsche Bank. And then locally, the Deutsche Bank Labs office was here housed for a year before they built out their Palo Alto office. And in fact, they still keep the space here just because there's so much activity. So for a startup, when you're thinking about what's most important as far as getting to market, time is typically the big issue. You're in a race before your burn is gone. And in addition to that, you need to validate perhaps something that's not been in market. So we try to flatten that process. And the way that we do that is, again, through a C-level executive that can earmark internally the resources that are available through both their innovation strategy as well as general corporate strategy. The innovation-facing team, so the funnel that's looking at shiny things and bringing it back to the business units. And then we go deep into the actual business units. So a lot of the startups that participate in the FinTech program are B2B, about 80% of them. So at the end of the day, the user is typically one of these business units. And we go there first. And so we source specific use cases and scopes from these folks. We filter it through the innovation team. We validate it through the executive. And what that means for the startup is, regardless if you're early through growth, now you have at least a binary answer faster than you'd ever have. So there's one big save. Secondly, the thesis for us is, it's great to get funding through an accelerator program, but a Fortune 500 client is far more powerful. And we point towards Palantir with what they did in the early 2000s. They were able to come out here and parade down Sand Hill Road with a 10-year JP Morgan contract. So you can imagine, as a VC, when you see that kind of logo and that brand behind you with that longevity attached to, a nice revenue stream, that's very exciting for the partner. So for us, we're not a big investor. We don't invest a lot of money. We invest up to about $500,000. But the real true value is through our network and over the years, we connect you to the folks that are decision makers. And we do it in such a way that it really saves you a lot of time. And eventually, the hope is you become a PayPal and one of those unicorns we've worked with.
Talk a little bit more about the flip side. What's in it for the financial institutions that are members and sponsors?
Well, I think there's a number of value props to the financial institution. I think there's a lot of noise generally when you look across corporate innovation. There's many different programs out there, each kind of serving a different offering to the partners. And we've seen early stage incubator programs, we've seen labs, we've seen consortiums. To the partner, it's really important to be able to tell the difference between a great startup and the best startup. There's a lot of startups out there with many different ideas. Our strong point is knowing the entrepreneur and validating them against some of the experiences they've had. And basically, it's a litmus test or a vehicle for diligence for us through our community. So the partner, the financial institution in this case, not only gets to understand particularly, you know, the two kind of areas perhaps that it's most relevant for the startup to engage with them, whether that's, you know, a white label offering or a unique offering specific to that company. But now they also sit at a table with 30 or so other financial institutions that often have a very similar problem. So they see a horizontal understanding of what is the market doing. And secondly, you know, it also, again, getting back to this competitive environment, if they see one of their competitors are working with one of our startups, they're probably going to look a little bit closer to them. So the value prop at the end of the day is twofold to the corporate. We help you save money with the later stage companies because they have a product that's ready to work, proven track record, validated by market. So that's a company that maybe we don't invest in, but we put in front of that decision maker and we expedite that business development process. The second is the line of sight into maybe 2 to 5 years down the road. So think of this as the creative destruction avenue. What's coming at you, perhaps in an iterative cycle that's faster than you can respond? And if you are in that position, what are the opportunities you might have to hedge against that problem?
So when you launched the fintech vertical, what was different about that than some of the prior verticals that you've launched? And do they approach it differently, or was it pretty similar to other industries?
So I think, you know, finance is very unique. And I'd actually argue it's closer to things like the health division that we work with here. There's a number of different considerations with that. One is just private information. There's a lot of private information across all you know, transactions, so forth. Particularly when you deal with sovereign states, we have partners from virtually every continent. I think that, you know, the second big area that you know, is very unique as well is just the fact that they're taking custody of funds. This is, hey, if you do this, you're going to find yourself in federal prison, and guess what? You probably will never be back in financial services. Mm-hmm. So there's a very nuanced diligence from the startup and the entrepreneur's perspective to understand, look, you know, if I'm doing cross-border payments, there's this thing called OFAC travel rule, and I better pay attention to that. And if I don't, you know, there's a really creepy seller somewhere where I'm probably going to get, you know, wind up. And that's a big problem, because on the flip side, it presents a very large amount of friction for the entrepreneur to get off the ground. And we've seen this a few times, but I think, you know, when you look at financial institutions and some of the regulations that are required also, just both from an investment perspective, we've had scenarios where some of our strategics attempted to invest in some of our startups and, you know, you'd have to pull up an 1890s banking law. And there's a lot of kind of archaic vestiges of old, non-relevant, you know, impasse for these entrepreneurs and these big banks. So for us, the reality is we have to navigate both. We have witnessed this firsthand with Lending Club. They had to shut down for roughly 9 months to get the correct MSB licensing. And so, again, that's kind of the beauty of the longevity that we've had in this domain. So with finance, not only do we invest in PayPal and Lending Club, but we get to reap the benefits of the lessons learned. So when Renault or John Donovan mentors our fintech startups, which is now very relevant for our blockchain companies or our Bitcoin companies, that comes with them, you know, tier one, high grade, very experienced knowledge that I think is very exclusive.
So there's the regulatory complexity that's added in financial services. How about in the corporate culture? Is it similar? Is it different from some of the other verticals you work with?
So I think when we look at the different industries, it's very clear that you know, financial technology is an area we've seen a lot of corporate activity. 1 out of 4 investments have come from a corporate venture arm in the past 4 years. That's a lot more activity than I'd say what we've seen in healthcare or even in insurance. And then when you map some of the emerging technologies across some of the activity, so for example, blockchain, we'd say financial institutions are probably 2-3 years ahead of any other industry. You know, at least 1 year ahead of insurance, probably 2 years ahead of health. So there is a lot more activity from the investment perspective. I think secondly, we see that there's a significant shift in retail banking in particular. And it's very similar to what we're seeing in the retail domain generally. Consolidation of brick and mortar, removal of particular markets. There's a lot of folks being laid off and replaced with technology. So in that case, there's almost this impetus, this quick kind of need to act fast. And I think with that, we've seen in the past 4 years, a number of these FIs you know, with $50 million, $100 million funds, which to me points towards, yeah, they're responding to a pretty significant change. If you track a lot of the margins for these products as well, you'll see it's a very different ballgame than it was 5 years ago.
Have you seen an evolution in the types of solutions and maybe the approaches? And as you say, this is your fifth cohort.
That's
for
right.
The fintech vertical. How's that changed over the years?
So I think if there's one area we've seen a significant push, I mean, generally because of our partners and how we play, we're very much infrastructure and B2B oriented. So I'd argue that's the less sexy domain. Yeah, it's not consumer facing, it's not significant growth. So we're not talking about, you know, something that everyone will talk about or use as functional word or, you know, things like that. But you know, when you look at, I'd say, the three or four major trends we've seen in the past 2 years, it's compliance, identity, artificial intelligence, and blockchain. These are the four areas we've seen a lot of activity. Maybe 4 years ago, it was lending, a lot of lending solutions in market. I still think that, you know, there's a lot of growth in the lending space, and we've seen significant growth across all markets, for that matter. But yeah, I think right now we're getting closer and closer to the areas that have the most, I'd say, entrenched or legacy-like, you know, in production offerings. So there's a big shift in digitization that's occurred over the past 5 years, and now we're getting into the very meat and core, I'd say, of, you know, the core competency of a lot of these financial institutions. Whereas before, maybe it's a tack-on or an add-on solution. We need a new product, we need a new business line, or we need to enter a new market. So let's buy this company, or let's white label this offering, or, you know, if you're PayPal, let's take care of Venmo, and we'll see how we can extend to that millennial demographic. But yeah, generally speaking, I think, at least in this point, we're looking at very significant change from the core kind of infrastructure we've seen globally.
Plug and Play has obviously wildly succeeded in helping fintech startups and larger companies work together to the advantage of both. But their entry into fintech didn't start with payments, like another PayPal or Lending Club, which is another success story of theirs. It actually started with a Bitcoin vertical. And to understand that, you have to know some of Scott's own journey into fintech.
You know, from my background, when I got out of school, I went into commercial real estate and hated my life. So in the evenings, I learned how to code. And I ran a utility audit against about 400 retail locations that we had. So I wrote a script, which basically mapped out square footage against consumption for whatever utility it might be. And so anytime a new invoice came in, I could quickly understand whether or not it was within an order of magnitude of being correct or not. So some interesting stuff came out of that. One, I uncovered a pretty large account in Lake Forest, which turns out we've been paying the entire landscaping water bill for about 30 different retail offices for 10 years. So that was interesting. And the second thing was a pretty significant embezzlement scandal. So we ended up putting a couple people in prison because there was north of $1 million that was being signed over back to a couple of people at the company. So at that moment, I thought, okay, I need to be in technology. And so I'd been looking for a way to kind of venture into the space, and Bitcoin came along, and I was in education tech. And, you know, at the end of the day, we were trying to build a solution for teachers to share lesson plans. And it became very clear for us to be successful in creating opportunity for students, you needed money. And so it was a very good time for me to read the white paper when it first came out. And so I remember showing up at Blue Ocean Sushi on El Camino here in Sunnyvale. And there was, you know, less than 15 people talking about why this was important and what it meant. And they're all technical. And so I was able to learn from, I'd say, the brightest minds in Bitcoin at that time. A lot of them were core developers. And when I was working at Plug and Play, I was consulting at first in 2013. So this is like March 2013. And that was right around the time, if you were paying attention to Bitcoin, because I've been watching it for a couple of years at that point, one of the first big conferences was that May 2013. And the price ticked up to its high at that moment, which was about $263. So there's a lot of new people looking at the space. I actually was showing up to the Bitcoin meetup that Roger Ver, the Bitcoin Jesus guy, ran all throughout here.
Roger Ver, as some of our listeners may know, was a very early Bitcoin evangelist. He started some of the first Bitcoin meetups and earned the moniker Bitcoin Jesus.
And so in the very early days, these meetups were, you know, a bunch of developers looking to overthrow central governments, or, you know, very, I'd say, early idealistic assertion. A good friend of the company, Michael Yang from My Simon Game, and Saeed, my CEO, and I were at this meetup, and Michael basically said, you know, I went to a club just like this called Homebrew in the 1970s, and I'm seeing the exact same thing, so pay attention.
Michael Yang is part of the Silicon Valley lore. Homebrew, the club he attended, was a computer hobbyist club that started meeting in 1975. You may have heard of a few of their members, guys like Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, Roger Mellon, Paul Terrell, Lee Chen Wang, Steve Innes. They basically became the spine of Silicon Valley innovation.
And that's when my CEO turned to me and said, Scott, go make a Bitcoin accelerator. My job was to create a small incubator program with Bitcoin startups. But that was also right around the time we heard a couple large strategics like USAA, BBVA were shopping to make a strategic investment in either Coinbase, Ripple, or Zappo. And it was that point in which we pivoted to open up all the activity to general financial technology while maintaining a blockchain track. So since then, we launched Improper, like to say February 2015. We're on batch 5 today, so you're here today for our demo day. About 22 startups went through this last class. So we, in total now, accelerated 129 companies here in the U.S. And then we've launched, as of March, another program in Paris with BNP Paribas. So another 10 companies will go through there twice a year.
So is your interest now, as you think about Bitcoin initially as a cryptocurrency, and then how the underlying blockchain and distributed ledger technologies have kind of broken out beyond use as a currency. Talk about how your own personal interest and view has evolved, and also how that's impacted the kind of companies that you're seeing come through here.
I'm in an interesting position. Right now, I'm sure you're aware, there's a pretty significant debate going on as it relates to the block size and the solution that's in market for SegWit. I'm kind of nestled in between the two parties, so I work with both sides. My personal opinion is Bitcoin is the only true solution right now that's in production that has a significant value apart from the upside that we're seeing in Ethereum and a couple of the other projects that are coming about. So I wouldn't call myself a Bitcoin maximalist or purist, but at the end of the day, I think there's still quite a tail and a long, long position for Bitcoin. At the core, I think the thesis of a lot of the folks that were in that room at these meetups was Bitcoin was meant to extend opportunity to send, receive, and store money, particularly for those that are underserved, but yet they have extension or the channel, at least with a device, that they could have this opportunity. And I think we're beginning to see that right now. I have to say, I probably had maybe 100 different meetings where I got left out of the room, and now they've all come back asking for help as it relates to blockchain. So things have changed quite a bit in the past 4 years.
You also have a lot of companies in the fintech vertical focused on artificial intelligence and machine learning. Where does that fit into your prognostications of the future?
You know, artificial intelligence is often it's a very confusing word for a lot of different folks in this world. It's a very straightforward use case for finance. I think it's fraud, customer acquisition, and customer behavior understanding. This is best evidenced by how we see the trees of response for chatbots, kind of the concierge services, and how you might escalate up through the required human interaction. So I think when you look at AI, if you're not in the business or you're not playing a game in AI, you'll probably be out of business in 10, 15 years, period. It's the next kind of significant impact for many of the different services across all of finance, whether that's underwriting and risk management to things like stress testing. So we have companies that are offering stress testing solutions to some of the large FIs. The reality is at some point in the next 20 years, this is going to move magnitudes beyond our comprehension. And so if you don't have at least a seed attempting to be sprouted in the next year or two, you'll probably be left behind. Now, there's a lot of fear-mongering in that statement, but so I think the fear-mongering stems from the lack of talent that's available. We see every industry going after artificial intelligence developers at this time. And so, the tier one universities have, pretty often now built out a lab or some sort of interaction with a third party so they can actually, get that channel to the talent. So in that case, I think, when you consider the divide between maybe the tier ones that have the sort of budget that can, put up the $3 million for the lab at Stanford or elsewhere, comparative to those regional or community banks or even tier two banks or any folks that would be of the similar kind of position within their respective industry, there's going to be a lot of trouble for them. And I think while we see a lot of the banks kind of reconciling and pulling back with particular markets, they'll probably come back 10 years from now with an artificial power solution that is on your device. And I think that's kind of what we expect. So on the fraud side, I mean, we see a lot of interesting use cases, not just for payments and other stuff. I mean, I think this is even best highlighted with what we saw with Wells Fargo in the past few months. The ability to differentiate between an actual human asking for a service compared to an upsell or something like that. There's a lot of reasons for which you'd want artificial intelligence across your stack.
And the larger the data sets get, the better that artificial intelligence can help.
Absolutely. And if there's one thing a lot of these folks have, it's lots of data. And they're sitting on this gold mine. So how do you mine that? How do you push that to a new solution or optimize your current? I think that's the big play. And you either have it or you don't.
So you talked about the evolution of the fintech vertical from customer-facing kind of incremental product innovation and so on, moving now much deeper into the technology stack and also deeper into the business model. And I'm wondering if that aligns with what you've just talked about, which is the technology is getting more complex. Now, we're not just talking about how do we have a better mobile app, but if we're going to use artificial intelligence and blockchain and some of these cybersecurity solutions, do you think those trends are moving in tandem?
I'd say, you know, cybersecurity and artificial intelligence will go hand in hand. We've seen a number of significant breaches in the, you know, many different markets over the past few years. You know, notable ones would be the Bangladeshi Bank, QNB. We've seen on the, you know, on the payment side with retail, you know, retailers like Target and PF Chang's and the Sony Networks. A lot of this stuff has, you know, really quickly pointed to the fact that, hey, we're not quite up to snuff as it relates to your edge security or your security strategy. The reality is it's going to move even faster. You know, we do see significant infrastructure problems right now with, you know, we've had notices from three-letter agencies relating to the standard encryption offerings and challenges there. So I think, yes, there's both the artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, I'd say, kind of relationship where, you know, using identity, for example, we have a company called Blockseer that can scrape against all this, you know, dark web activity, handles, known associates, and kind of build out a nice, interesting model for the three-letter agency to understand who's doing what and where are they. And you pair that with, say, a financial institution's watch list or some sort of information that they may have against that. It becomes pretty powerful when it comes to understanding of the identity. At scope, right now, I mean, the reality is we're probably 5 years, 6 years away from a lot of this stuff really, truly becoming integral to the community and to the general ecosystem. But that's the other challenge is you talked about it from the start. There's a big misunderstanding and dichotomy between those that actually comprehend what's going on. And I think that's continuing to become further and further away. And this is a big challenge for a lot of the government agencies that regulate. You know, the education aspect for them is very difficult because the iterative process moves faster and it will continue to move faster.
So tell us what we're going to see today.
So today, today is our big demo day for our FinTech Batch 5. So you'll hear from Chris Skinner, who I think you guys know pretty well.
Good friend of the show.
That's right. So he'll be up giving a nice intro keynote, describing what he's seeing and some of the stuff like that. And then about 20 of our FinTech startups from this batch will be pitching. So they get 3 minutes on the stage. The assumption is if you can't get a good pitch out in 3 minutes, then you probably shouldn't be pitching here. Or at least the person you're pitching to won't be able to understand what you're doing. And so these folks are here to really highlight all the activity they've had in the past 3 months. We counted all this information up for our board meeting yesterday. So we actually have had close to 900 introductions over the 22 companies over the past 3 months. We've had 140 plus deal flows here on site. So at least one deal flow per day.
So if you're one of those companies demoing this afternoon, what's a big win for them? What do they hope happens at the end of the day?
So the outcome we're seeking for all these startups is at least one pilot and perhaps some fundraising that we've connected to either a VC, a friend of ours, or, you know, maybe we've put in some money. So we will ad hoc invest and cherry pick through the companies that go through the program. And sometimes we don't even have to have them go through the program. We'll invest outside of that. But couple that with how these slow financial institutions move is a big challenge. We hope they walk with a check or a contract.
So you talked about how the financial institutions move more slowly and with a more laborious process. That's something I've talked about a lot on the show and elsewhere. What are you doing to try to improve that?
So I think there's two ways to optimize the process for corporate innovation in fintech specifically. One is drilling down to as specific of a scope as possible. And by doing so, when we make the call for applications twice a year, we get about 1,000 responses. So we'll see maybe 20 to 30 of the same type of company going after the same kind of problem. So innately, we already know from the start, this corporate or this business unit is looking for this specific use case. From there, we kind of try to build out the best of breed for that use case. And so the reality is, you know, there's not really all that many unique ideas in the world. It's really how you execute. So for us, you know, when we look at what the options might be for the startup, we just want to make it clear that, look, we're going to give you a nice menu item for this particular product, what you're looking for. We're going to give you insight as to who we think will be the type that can execute it. And meanwhile, you know, through the program, the corporate often has to have at least earmarked a budget. We know there's a soft landing because we know which stakeholding business unit is going to be working with them. We've now validated it with the C-level. So the C-level will say, yep, that's right. And you can imagine when a C-level says that, things happen.
Well, thanks for joining us for Breaking Banks today. When we come back, we'll be taking you into the demo day, and we'll introduce you to three of the entrepreneurs who are demoing their companies, Flutterwave, Big ID, and Zomigo. We'll be right back with more Breaking Banks.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity. This podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. And in this segment, we want to take you into the Plug and Play Demo Day. It's a gorgeous day in Silicon Valley, almost stereotypically gorgeous. The demo tent is packed, standing room only. In fact, there's barely any standing room. People are hanging at the doors of the tent, trying to get a peek inside, realizing that they may not even get to see the whole event. The event starts out pretty typically. Max Koenig, head of business development, Nadine Schubert, head of operations, do the basic intros.
For those of you that do not know me, my name is Max. I manage most of the corporate relationships here over at Plug and Play FinTech. To my right is Nadine. She pretty much is the glue together when it comes to early startups.
Thanks everybody for coming here. My name is Nadine.
There'll be 90 startups who demo here today. They have 3 minutes each to make their pitch. As usual, they have a luminary come and speak, and today it's a good friend, Chris Skinner. Sometimes I think it's the speaker's job to inspire. Today, my producer wonders if Chris isn't here to scare the crap out of the big organizations as a final push today before they leave.
Let's process it and focus upon operational excellence, getting everything right all the time. Then you have this lovely customer intimate experience front office that's meant to be the best it can be, although for many financial institutions, they find this is the weakest part of their process.
We can't possibly give you an idea about all the companies, but we chose three to highlight because they were working on different solutions in different geographies and to give you a taste of the broad mission that Plug and Play has. We're starting with...
Nice. So my name is Iyoluwa Aboyeji. And my company is Flutterwave.
But he gave us permission to call him E.
And you can just call me E.
Okay. Gentlemen, my name is E, and I am CEO and co-founder of Flutterwave. And I'm Flutterwave.
Flutterwave comes from concept in chaos theory, which is called the butterfly effect, right? Like, that's the scientific name. And so when we're starting the company, the idea was... Our mission was we wanted to build a new wave of prosperity across Africa by connecting Africa to the global economy. So the idea is we're going to fix this technology and infrastructure thing. We'll share a highway with everybody, and then we'll watch the impact of that completely transform the continent.
So tell us about Flutterwave.
Yeah, so we build technology and infrastructure for financial institutions in Africa to process payments. And the background for why we exist is basically, you know, everywhere else in the world, card payments are basically the de facto. 60% of payments processed is credit cards or debit cards. However, in Africa, less than 1% is credit cards or debit cards. So it's an entirely different world. And what you actually have is a situation where digital payments, even though it's a big market, it's $380 billion in payments in across Africa every year, is very balkanized. Essentially, there's just a lot of mobile money schemes, a lot of bank payment schemes, all sorts of stuff. And people find it, you know, merchants find it very difficult to know which one to stake their company on. And so that often means that they just default to cash. And so what we decided to do was we said, okay, we're going to try and aggregate all these different payment methods so that merchants don't have to worry about staking on which payment method is going to be the most popular, and they can just accept whatever the customer pops onto the till with. And then we decided we wouldn't just give this tool to the merchant, we would let other people give it to merchants as well. And so we're very unique from your typical merchant aggregator or whatever, in the sense of payment FAQ, in the sense that our infrastructure and technology would power, PayFAQs. It empowers financial institutions who want to provide merchant processing services to their customers. It empowers fintech companies who are looking to add payments to their offerings. And that's possible because we have a really flexible API, which anybody can basically build into their product and be able to accept any method of payment via any channel. It's been fun. It's been a year now. We've processed over $1 billion in transactions. And we've been able to attract a lot of, some of the largest and best investors in Silicon Valley and around the world. It's growing every day, over 40 people. It's a pretty interesting business to build.
Should you work with M-Pesa?
Yes, we do
other
work.
Mobile money platforms?
Yep, we have to. We work with M-Pesa. We have a growing business in Kenya where we support both M-Pesa and bank account payments on behalf of merchants.
And where are you based?
Our headquarters is in San Francisco. We're over in North Beach, but we also have offices around the world. So we have an office in London. We have one of our largest offices is in Nigeria. We have an office in Nairobi. We have an office in Cape Town.
So how did you get involved with Plug and Play?
So it was pretty interesting. I think they actually came after us. I'm not sure where they hear about us, but we were at Y Combinator before. And we got an email from somebody at Plug and Play. Hey, we'd like to work with you guys. We're thinking about doing this fintech thing. And, we had accelerator fatigue, quite frankly. It was like another one. But, we decided to give it a shot. I'm actually a pretty big fan of Plug and Play because I'd known about them when I was in university in Waterloo. And I'd come in touch with one of their partners back when. I figured, let's look at it. And when we came here, we were super impressed at the community of financial institutions they brought together, who they had access to, the people, really, that's really what it was about for us. And we're like, yeah, man, we'd love people like this to support us, especially folks like Scar and Sahil. So we're like, yeah, it's another accelerator. We're kind of tired, but we'll do this one.
So how is this different than an accelerator like Y Combinator?
I think it's different in the sense that, Y Combinator, I like to compare it to grad school, right? That's like, no one really expects you to, you attend one class a week. It's called the Tuesday dinner. And then, you go to your office hours with your prof and he talks and there's a little bit of a session and you go do your own thing, right? Quite frankly, at the time, that was the kind of accelerator we needed, right? Someone who was just going to hold us accountable to get stuff done, right? Plug and Play is different. It's kind of like the World Trade Center accelerator, kind of. You know what I mean? It's basically like there's so much. And you kind of have to come in here very focused about what it is that you wanted. And what we wanted out of this was we wanted a bank partner in another part of the world, because we have Nigeria pretty much on lockdown in a lot of the African countries. We wanted somewhere else in Africa. And we've been working very well with Nedbank in that respect. And then we wanted a U.S. bank partner, which we're still working on, so that we could basically start to build out not just an African network for a payment processing business, but a global network. They've been very helpful.
So what do you hope happens today? What's a good outcome for you?
I think that, there's a lot of good outcomes. I mean, over the last, since we started, we pretty much I think when we came in, we were telling Plug and Play we've done $200 million in TPV. Today we do that every month, like, you know. So just in terms of like, you know, we've just grown so much. And, you know, from the back of that, we're working on a Series A financing on the back of that. You know, there's a lot of really great stuff happening. But I think, so I'm less about the traditional outcomes in terms of, oh, you know, we'll be able to raise a round, maybe find a new bank partners. I'm okay with where we are right now. We're looking for more, but I think more on the business side. But I think the most important thing for me to do in our pitch is to really bring more attention to the problem that we're trying to solve, right? We live in a world where if we're really thinking about the future, it's in Africa. And I don't just say that like as a, you know, cliche thing. I mean, just look at the demographics, right? Like, you know, in the next 20 years, half of the world's working population is going to live in Africa, right? The average age of the continent is 19 plus. So if we're thinking about who's really going to be living here in the next 50 years, it's probably going to be a lot of people who look like me and a lot less people who look like you. That's just the fact. And the fact that today we're just pretending like the continent doesn't exist is kind of short-sighted. And I think for me today, it's really going to be, you know, with all those big banks in the room, being able to tell them, look, man, you know, this is where the future is. And you can get there late or you can cry about it like you did about China, but it's the last stand. And you have a choice there. You can either work with, you know, entrepreneurs, not just me, but several others around the world, to build the future of Africa, or you can ignore it and ultimately find yourself in a completely different future than you were imagining.
That's great.
Next company is Big ID.
I obviously got pretty bad at video games because I'm not here to present anything about games. So, my name is Dimitri Sroda. As you know, I'm a three-time entrepreneur focused on securities.
Sure, my name is Dimitri Sroda. My company is Big ID. So Big ID focuses on helping organizations understand what customer data they collect and process so they can better protect it, so they can better deal with privacy issues around that data, and so they can basically better understand their customers.
How did you have the idea to start this company?
So after I sold my last company, also in the security space about 4 years back, mostly focused on acquisitions, and I saw that a lot of the companies I was looking at for acquisition had nothing to do with the actual protection of identity data. And as I commuted into the city from Westchester where I live, it struck me that there was nothing purpose-built for the actual protection and privacy of identity data, and that problems around data loss, data misuse, data abuse wouldn't get any better unless you had something that understood the data itself.
So how did you come to be involved with Plug and Play?
So we were introduced through one of our seed investors, and they suggested that we talk to them based on the program that they run. That was the entree into the program.
What's the experience been like so far?
The experience has been terrific. They've been very helpful. They've introduced us to people both here and in New York City, and now Paris, since they've started and launched a new program there as well. And they've been extremely supportive throughout the few months.
Do you see more opportunity in Europe with the pending regulation that's coming there?
You know what? So I think you always see more opportunity wherever you are, and I happen to be in New York. So when I look around, I don't necessarily see Russia or Europe. I see the U.S. But to some degree, it makes sense if you reflect on the fact that a lot of these new regulations that are driving privacy will probably be focused on outside European companies. So U.S. companies are prime targets for a lot of the penalties and fines, because again, U.S. companies also deal with European citizen data.
And talk a little bit about the regulation that's coming.
So there's a number of them. The one that we focus our attention on is something called the EU General Data Protection Regulation. And it's a law that was enacted in April of last year. So that's 2016. It takes effect in May of 2018. The headline is the reason that companies care about it. The headline is that the penalties could range up to 4% to 10% of your global revenue per country. So that's 28 countries that can now level penalties 4% to 10% on a company's revenue. So you can imagine that's very sobering.
Regardless of where you're based.
Regardless, even if it's a purely American company that doesn't even have operations in Europe, if they have a European citizen customer. I was with a large SI yesterday that's based in Australia. They're covered. If there's a French citizen living in Australia, they have the same rights wherever they are around the world. And basically, this regulation creates new obligations for companies. So first and foremost is this idea that the data belongs to you, meaning that you could request the data, you could ask to be forgotten or deleted, right to be forgotten, you've probably heard that phrase. You could port your data, but that requires companies to rethink how they actually manage, find, account for the data that they collect. And there's a number of other requirements. So it's a complicated piece of legislation, and it just so happens that our product, our kind of big data for identity information product, answers a lot of the questions that companies have around meeting and satisfying GDPR.
How do you feel about the GDPR requirements?
How do I feel? I feel great. How do companies feel? I think they feel terrible, but for me, it's terrific.
Because you're going to benefit.
I'm going to benefit immensely.
For people, for citizens.
I think obviously setting aside big IDs, self-interest, it's terrific. It's the right way. I think privacy has been the ugly stepchild of security for far too many years. So there's been a focus on preventing hackers and attackers, but there really hasn't been a focus on safeguarding, you know, what is arguably the lifeblood of your business.
So what do you hope is an outcome today?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I'm pitching actually. I need to step away right before my pitch to talk to a VC. So we've had a few inbound interest from investors. And obviously, we're a startup. We're looking to raise money. We're interested in access to corporate accounts. Most of our clients are Dow 30, Fortune 100, Fortune 200. And so having access to these organizations, either in the security, privacy, or data governance teams is valuable. So that's the real hope.
Great. Well, best of luck to you today.
Thank you very much.
And our final pitch today is from...
I'm Chirag Bakshi, founder and CEO of Zomigo.
So at Zomigo, we leverage mobile network data to secure financial transactions, identify mobile devices and their owners, and authenticate access.
What does that mean? We provide mobile identity and mobile location technologies for securing transactions. For example, if you were to make a credit card purchase, whether it's in-store or online, we can tell where the user is located by checking where their phone is located. And we locate the phone without having an app on the phone. We locate the phone using cell towers. We locate the phone and say, does it make sense that the transaction is happening? Whether it's in-store or online, we check and we validate transactions. The other aspect of what we do is we also do mobile identity. So if you're doing any activity on your phone, we know what the phone number is and who it is. So we're providing banks and financial institutions the ability to know when somebody is accessing their systems, who it is, right? And we then validate saying, is it the same as the account owner or is it somebody else? So essentially what we do is we provide security, whether it's financial transaction, whether it's login access, authentication of users using our technology, and it's seamless. There's no app needed on the phone.
How did you become involved with Plug and Play?
Plug and Play, so what happened was, I wish I knew, we could access Plug and Play when we started off. We actually started off more than 5 years ago. And I think there was a fintech program late last year that we heard of, and we looked at what the fintech program does, and I think it was through some press release or blogs or somewhere I found out, and I looked at the fintech program, and we were interested in the fact that there were so many corporate sponsors, banking customers that are part of the network and the sponsors, and so we thought it was a cool way to add and meet our customers. We didn't need funding because we were further along, 5 years into it, and so we had good customers, our technology was proven, we were in growth mode, and then we said, well, this is a nice way, our office is just a mile away. Rather than us visiting customers, we could see customers and partners in the space.
So a lot of your motivation was access to potential customers.
Yeah, that's right. Access to potential customers, brand awareness, making sure our potential customers were aware of what we do. We're still so small. We don't spend a whole lot on marketing and making ourselves known. So this was a nice way. And so we really like it.
So did you still evolve the product along the way? So as you started 5 years ago, you joined Plug and Play fairly well positioned in terms of having product market fit. Did you still learn something along the way?
Yeah, so let me, color that with. So the first, fintechs, the financial customers have long sales cycles. So first 2-3 years was testing the technology, doing pilots. And, especially the last 2 years is when technology was proven. And we're still evolving our product. You know, we have, for example, location solution, and we've developed an SDK and a mobile app version. We have mobile identity solutions that we launched a year and a half ago. We're evolving into providing payment security. So we've added card transaction validation, where we actually validate that a credit card is owned by that consumer. So card validation was added as well. So we're constantly evolving our technology as we see different use cases and the need from FIs and processors.
So were those iterations a direct result of interaction with the corporate sponsors here?
Well, what I would say is the corporate sponsors here, we had done some pilots and trials with them, and then teams changed. And what it allowed us is to re-engage with finding out what the new teams are, and so re-establishing relationships and partners. And then, of course, all our customers take us into evolution of the product. And, this is a 2-3 month program, so I wouldn't say we made evolution in the last 3 months, but I think we learn as we talk to more customers, and we are constantly evolving our product.
So what will be a good outcome for you today?
Today is we expect to make our technology known to a much broader audience. We expect that folks will reach out to us, because of this.
Good. Wait, what else?
What's your background?
My background is...
What did you do before you started this company?
So I've been in Silicon Valley for 30 plus years, and I built PBX switches, starting off telecom PBX switches. Then I worked for Apple, ran their LaserWriter product team for 4 years in the early 90s. Since late 90s, I've been in the mobile space. I built a company that we sold to VeriSign, and we ended up doing all the text messaging, picture video messaging that happens in North America and US, Canada. We built the solutions. So the platforms we built run 10 billion transactions a day today. VeriSign disintegrated in 2008. They sold off all the businesses, and then couple of years break, and then I started Zumigo because of personal experiences when I was traveling. My card was denied, and there were fraud charges out of Eastern Europe, and so that's how I started Zumigo.
All right, well, good luck today. Thank you.
So nice to talk to you.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us on this special episode of Breaking Banks. I'm JP Nichols. We'll see you again next week with more FinTech. Remember to subscribe to us on iTunes and check out Sam Mall's FinTech 5 podcast.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.